BTO Beyond the Obvious, der Ökonomie-Podcast mit Dr. Daniel Stelter. Featured bei Handelsblatt.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe meines Podcasts. In dieser Woche blicken wir auf ein hochspannendes Thema, nämlich die Frage, ob die Jahrzehnte tiefer Zinsen und geringer Inflationsraten dauerhaft vorbei sind. Vor nicht wenigen Jahren gab es ja die These, es gebe nie wieder Zinsen. 2019 schrieb beispielsweise die Zeit, hurra, der Zins ist weg. Die FAZ sagte, es gebe im Prinzip wohl nie wieder Zinsen. Titel des Artikels, drohen uns Jahrzehnte ohne Zinsen. Das war das Jahr 2019. Danach kam Corona und die Zinsen gingen nochmal richtig runter. Dann kam Inflation, die Zinsen stiegen an, befinden sich heute auf einem höheren Niveau als 2019. Die große Frage ist natürlich nun, wie geht es weiter? Gehen die Zinsen wieder zurück, bleiben sie, wo sie sind, oder droht gerade ein weiterer Anstieg? Und da gibt es in der Tat interessante Theorien, die das analysieren und von Leuten, die bereits 2020 gesagt haben, die Zeit der tiefen Zinsen ist demnächst vorbei. Das Ganze ist gerade im heutigen Umfeld hochaktuell, hochrelevant. Und deshalb rufen wir uns dieses Gespräch, welches meines Erachtens zu einem der besten gehört, welches ich jemals bei BTO geführt habe, wieder in Erinnerung. Ich hoffe, Sie finden es auch spannend. Fangen wir also an. Im Februar 2021 hatte ich an dieser Stelle Charles Goodhart und Manoj Pradhan zu Gast. Das wird Ihnen vielleicht nicht viel sagen, aber Charles Goodhart, mittlerweile 90 Jahre alt, ist einer der ganz großen Ökonomen Großbritanniens. Die beiden haben 2020 ein Buch auf den Markt gebracht. Titel The Great Demographic Reversal. Ein provokanter Titel, aber vor allem war der Inhalt provokant. Ihre Kernthese war folgende. Die Zeit der niedrigen Inflation sei historisch beendet, meinten die beiden. Aus zwei Gründen. Zum einen, weil es einen Angebotsschock gab durch den Eintritt Chinas und Osteuropas in den weltweiten Arbeitsmarkt. Hinzu kommt der deutliche Anstieg der Erwerbsbeteiligung von Frauen. Beide Faktoren führten quasi zum Überangebot an Waren und damit zu geringer Inflation. Doch genau das dreht sich jetzt um, wir wissen es. Das Arbeitsangebot schrumpft. Nicht nur bei uns im Westen, schon bald auch in China. Und die Abhängigenquote, also diejenigen, die quasi leben von den Einkommen der anderen, geht nach oben. Auch das wird Inflation, Zinsen und Löhne nach oben treiben. In diesem Jahr erschien ein neues Buch der beiden Autoren, The Unanchored Central Banker. Hier verschärfen sie ihre These nochmal und kombinieren sie mit einem Thema, welches sie im Podcast auch schon mehrmals besprochen haben, die fiskalische Dominanz. Die Kernaussage, die Staaten werden auf das Problem Demografie mit noch mehr Schulden antworten, sind bereits hochverschuldet und den Notenbanken wird nichts anderes übrig bleiben, als dem Druck der Politik nachzugeben und die Finanzierung der Staaten, die Solvenz der Staaten, über die Bewahrung des Geldwertes stellen. Das Szenario ist ganz klar. Wir werden quasi in ein strukturelles Umfeld höherer Inflation, höherer Zinsen und natürlich auch steigender Löhne kommen. Die Implikationen dürften weitreichend sein und werden uns am kommenden Sonntag in der nächsten Ausgabe beschäftigen. An dieser Stelle genügt Charles Goodhart zu zitieren, der im Interview mit der Financial Times gesagt hat, "From now on, demography is going to make life worse and worse and worse." Er meinte damit nicht die erfreuliche Tatsache, dass wir alle älter werden, sondern das Problem, das das Ganze hat fürs Finanzsystem. Wie relevant das ist, wissen wir auch in Deutschland. So rechnete das IFO-Institut vor einigen Wochen vor, dass ungefähr 70% des Sozialbudgets in Gesundheit und Rente fließen. Also altersgetriebene Ausgabenkategorien. Die Sozialquote ist in Deutschland in den letzten 30 Jahren von ungefähr 26,4 auf nun 31% des Bruttoinlandsproduktes gestiegen. Wobei rund 80% des Ausgabenanstiegs seit 1992 nur mit der demografischen Entwicklung erklärt werden können. Wir sehen hier also die Wirkung der Demografie auf die Staatsfinanzen. Ähnliches gilt übrigens auf europäischer Ebene. Der Kronberger Kreis um Lars Feld, Clemens Fuß, Volker Wieland und andere Ökonomen hat eine Studie vorgelegt mit dem Titel »Ist der Euro zukunftsfest?« Die zentrale Antwort ist nein. Und zwar nicht wegen der einen oder anderen Reform, sondern vor allem auch wegen der impliziten Verpflichtungen in den Mitgliedstaaten. Die offiziellen Schulden sind ein Problem, die verdeckten Schulden dürften ein noch viel größeres Problem werden. Das Ganze führt eben zu dem Thema, dass die Notenbanken letztlich nicht mehr unabhängig sein werden. Scholz-Guthardt brachte das in seinem Interview in der Financial Times so auf den Punkt. Fiscal policy has become so unsustainable and so precarious that monetary policy cannot easily work, particularly not in its regular form of raising interest rates. Die Diagnose ist relativ klar. Demografie treibt die Fiskalausgaben. Steigende Zinsen sind der normale Reflex, würden aber die Fiskalausgaben bzw. die Staatshaushalte endgültig in die Schieflage bringen. Deshalb wird es finanzielle Repression geben. Es wird tiefe Zinsen geben, es wird Anleihenkäufe geben und gleichzeitig werden wir einen Anziehen der Inflationsraten erleben. Und das ist das, was Charles Guthardt und Manoj Pradhan bereits im Jahre 2021 im Gespräch bei mir vorhergesagt haben. Es lohnt sich, genau dieses Gespräch nochmal in Erinnerung zu rufen, einfach deshalb, weil es aufzeigt, was auf uns zukommt, gesagt von Leuten, die es zu einem Zeitpunkt gesagt haben, als es noch eine ziemlich exotische Vorstellung war. Bevor wir zum Refresh kommen, noch kurz dieser Hinweis auf ein exklusives Angebot des Handelsblatts. Sie können für 4 Wochen lang das Handelsblatt Premium für nur 1 Euro abonnieren und so zur aktuellen Wirtschafts- und Finanzlage informiert bleiben. Mehr erfahren Sie unter handelsblatt.com/mehrperspektiven und natürlich wie immer auch in Shownotes zu dieser Ausgabe. Doch nun zu meinem Refresh mit Charles Guthardt und Manoj Pradhan.
Charles Guthardt, Jahrgang 1936, ist einer der prominentesten Ökonomen seiner Generation. Er war von 1968 bis 1985 an der Bank of England tätig, wurde 1997 Gründungsmitglied des Monetary Policy Committee der Bank of England und war bis 2000 dessen externes Mitglied. Von 1985 bis 2002 war er Professor an der London School of Economics, wo er die Financial Markets Group aufbaute. Bekannt wurde er auch durch das nach ihm benannte Guthardt-Gesetz. Sobald eine Messgröße zum Ziel wird, verliert sie ihre Aussagekraft. Heute ist Guthardt 90 Jahre alt und publiziert weiterhin. Manoj Pradhan, Jahrgang 1965, ist Gründer und Chefökonom von Talking Heads Macro, einer Research-Boutique in London. Er hat zuvor bei Morgan Stanley das globale Emerging Markets Research geleitet. Bei Charles Guthardt hat er promoviert und er ist seit Jahren sein wissenschaftlicher Co-Autor. Zusammen haben sie The Great Demographic Reversal und The Unanchored Central Banker verfasst.
Wie immer, bei englischsprachigen Interviews folgen nun die Highlights und am Ende des Podcasts dann das gesamte Gespräch im Original. Zunächst hatte ich mich ja gefragt, ob man rückblickend gesehen eigentlich die Entwicklung der letzten Jahrzehnte hätte vorhersehen können. Als ich als junger Sparer zum ersten Mal eine Bundesanleihe gekauft habe, Anfang der 80er Jahre, da habe ich einen Coupon bekommen von 10%. Und wenn ich zurückblicke, sage ich mir, naja, eigentlich wäre es ja vernünftig gewesen, damals mein ganzes Geld in die Hand zu nehmen, Anleihen zu kaufen mit 10%, Aktien zu kaufen, idealerweise noch Kredite aufzunehmen, um sozusagen diese Entwicklung von sinkenden Zinsen, sinkenden Inflationsraten, die natürlich entsprechend sich in den Finanzmärkten niedergeschlagen hat, in immer weiter steigende Bewertungen, auch im Immobilienmarkt, das mitzunehmen. Und da war meine Frage natürlich, hätte ich das vorhersehen können und vor allem, die andere Frage natürlich darauf, was müssen wir darauf basierend jetzt erwarten? Und die Antwort fand ich sehr interessant.
From about 1950 onwards, for the next 3 decades, there was a steady increase in inflation, in expectations of inflation and in nominal interest rates. That peaked at the end of the 70s, when Paul Volcker, with the support of Ronald Reagan and in the UK, Maggie Thatcher and Bundesbank in Germany, all succeeded in beating inflation. It was actually a quite difficult exercise, more difficult than those now in office actually remember clearly. And then, as you say, for the next 40 years from 1980 until the current period, interest rates, inflation, inflationary expectations have all come down.
Also Charles Goodhart beschreibt hier genau dasselbe, was ich auch gesagt habe, nämlich, dass wir in der Tat nach einer Phase hoher Inflation eine Politik der Inflationsbekämpfung hatten, angeführt von der US-Notenbank unter Paul Volcker, von der Bundesbank, selbst der Bank of England. Und das hat eben zu hohen Zinsen geführt damals, aber dann eben auch den Startschuss gegeben zu dieser Phase, wo wir im Prinzip sinkende Zinsen haben und entsprechend eine positive wirtschaftliche Entwicklung. Es ging also darum, die Inflationsmentalität zu brechen. Das war die Zielsetzung der Politik, damals unter Paul Volcker, aber auch von der Bundesbank, selbst von der Bank of England. Und das war schwerer aus heutiger Sicht, als man denkt. Es war wirklich schwer, das damals diese Inflationserwartungen zu brechen. Und es hatte zu tun mit besserer Geldpolitik und vor allem hatte es zu tun mit einem Politikwechsel. Davor lag der Fokus darauf, über keynesianische Nachfragepolitik die Arbeitslosigkeit weiter zu drücken, und zwar unter die natürliche Rate. Das hatte nicht mehr funktioniert, führte zur Inflation und, wie Goodhart betont, es war sehr schwer, diese Inflationsmentalität zu brechen und setzte entsprechend radikale Maßnahmen voraus. Aber es war nicht nur die Geldpolitik, die dazu geführt hat, dass die Inflationsraten zurückgegangen sind.
One of the points that we make in our book is that although a great deal of the return to low and stable inflation was due to better monetary regimes, it was also due to a background which was actually increasingly disinflationary, and that was largely due to globalization bringing about a huge increase in the availability of labor to those who could move their employment from high to low wage economies, and to demographic forces leading to a very sharp increase, not only in the working age population, but in the proportion of that population who were actual workers, as the reduction in the birth rate and other factors led to a very considerable increase in the participation of women in the number of those actually at work. Their participation increased very sharply.
Es war eben nicht nur die Geldpolitik, sondern eben auch die Demografie, die dieses disinflationäre Umfeld geschaffen hat. Das Umfeld sinkender Inflationsraten und letztlich auch sinkender Zinsen. Das lag zum einen an der Globalisierung, Markteintritt Osteuropas, Markteintritt Chinas. Aber es lag eben auch daran, dass aufgrund der rückläufigen Geburtenzahlen mehr Frauen der Erwerbstätigkeit nachgehen konnten. Es gab einfach weniger abhängige Menschen relativ zu denjenigen, die sie ernähren, einfach deshalb, weil wir weniger Kinder hatten. Dies wirkte deflationär. Und wie gesagt, China spielte dabei eine wichtige Rolle.
In 1990, China's share of exports in world trade was below 5%. By now, it's well above 25% and rising to about 30%. And the story of the rise of China is the most dramatic and most important economic development of the last 30 years.
Lag der Anteil Chinas am Welthandel bei nur ungefähr 5% im Jahre 1990, liegt er nun bei über 25%. Und das war sicherlich die dramatischste Entwicklung in der Weltwirtschaft in den letzten 30 Jahren. Und darauf basierend habe ich dann gefragt, ob dann die Notenbanken sich richtig verhalten haben, ob die Notenbanken denn vor diesem Hintergrund nicht anders hätten agieren müssten. Und da ist die Aussage ganz klar, naja, rückblickend gesehen wäre es besser gewesen, ein tieferes Inflationsziel anzustreben, also 0% statt 2%. Aber hier ist es halt so, dass man es rückblickend immer besser weiß.
I think that it would have been much better if the inflation target had been set at zero rather than 2%. But that is with the benefit of hindsight. And if you were sitting, as I was actually, in New Zealand when they were introducing the first inflation target at the end of the 1980s, we couldn't have foreseen the role of China. And at that time, I think 2% was actually about the right level to set it. And once it had been set, prior to the impact of China on the world economy at 2%, there were very good reasons for not changing what you had initially done. You start monkeying around with an inflation target, people will lose confidence in it and say they will always change it to whatever currently suits the political pressures of the moment. So I think what happened, in a sense, was inevitable. And I think that once the inflation target had been set at 2%, what followed was actually, it wasn't too bad. And if you take the period of the inflation targetary from 1991 up to the great financial crisis in 2007, 16 years, those were the best 16 years in the economic history of the world ever, by a long way. Poverty went down dramatically. Unemployment remained quite slow. Inflation was very low and stable at the target level. And there were problems about inequality growing within the advanced economies, and that was a problem. But apart from that, those 16 years of the Great Moderation were historically an absolutely wonderful period. And in some large part, we have to thank central banks for that. But with the benefit of hindsight, it would have been better if we'd gone for zero rather than two.
Zunächst betont Guthardt, dass man eben mit dem Inflationsziel nicht rumspielen sollte. Nachdem man 2% gesetzt hatte, sollte man jetzt nicht anfangen, das zu ändern, weil dann wird das Vertrauen in den Kapitalmärkten schwinden. Er betont aber dann auch, dass es ja eine super Zeit gewesen ist zwischen 1990 und der Finanzkrise. Es waren 16 super Jahre mit der besten wirtschaftlichen Entwicklung in der Weltgeschichte. Die Armut ist weltweit zurückgegangen. Die Beschäftigung blieb hoch, es gab geringe Inflationsraten, es gab Nebenwirkungen. Die Nebenwirkungen waren eine zunehmende Ungleichheit innerhalb der Industrieländer, während sie ja weltweit abgenommen hat, würde ich ergänzen. Und es gab sicherlich Blasenbildung an den Finanzmärkten. Aber abgesehen davon war es, Zitat, eine wundervolle Periode. Das Ganze hat natürlich auch damit zu tun, dass China nicht nur bedeutender geworden ist, sondern es liegt auch daran, wie China in die Weltwirtschaft eingetreten ist. Manoj Pradhan erklärt es, wie ich finde, sehr gut.
The way China was structured for such a huge economy was very different from the Western societies and economies in the sense that you could access China's economy if you wanted to invest physical capital in there, but you were not really allowed to access China's markets. So what they did with what is commonly known as the Impossible Trinity was they stopped capital flows at their doorstep. And that gave Chinese monetary and fiscal authorities a huge amount of control within the domestic economy to transfer, if you will, in a sense, funds over from the household sector to the banks and then to the state-owned enterprises. And if you wanted to access China's economy, then you had to go and invest physically in the Pearl River Delta or in other parts of China.
China ist nicht einfach in die Weltwirtschaft eingetreten, sondern hat es gesteuert gemacht. Vor allem verbunden mit erheblichen Kapitalverkehrskontrollen. Man konnte nicht einfach Geld aus China heraus transferieren. Und umgekehrt, wer immer in China Geschäfte machen wollte, musste dort entsprechend investieren und Kapital zuführen. Und diese einmalige Kombination aus Investitionsverpflichtung und billiger Arbeitskraft hat dazu geführt, dass China entsprechend schnell sich entwickeln konnte und machte die ganze Entwicklung so wirkungsvoll. Die naheliegende Frage dabei ist natürlich, wie steht es nun eigentlich um die Verschuldung Chinas? Denn wir wissen, dass gerade seit der Finanzkrise die Verschuldung in China sehr stark gewachsen ist, nicht nur absolut, sondern eben auch relativ zum Bruttoinlandsprodukt. Die Frage ist, setzt China zu viel auf Schulden?
Before 2015, there was a lot of optimism on the part of Chinese policymakers that growth would rise from 9.5 to 10 and then from 8 to 9 and then 7 to 8. And I think around 2015, the penny dropped after the domestic crash that they had at home. And since then, they have actually destroyed a huge amount of capacity in places like steel and other places where they had massive deflationary pressures building up. So they have fully realized that a lot of the physical capacity that they've built up and the debt that went to finance those capacities are going to produce no returns. And so if you can see the way they're trying to solve this problem is they have now released the state-owned enterprises from the role of being the primary drivers of investment. They're trying to get the private sector more involved, and to a large extent, they have succeeded in this. Not fully, because profitability still remains an issue. But I think the debt level story has been well understood and well absorbed, and they're trying to solve that with the debt to equity swaps. It's not an easy story. But the bigger concern, as far as expectations is concerned, is that people still think that China is going to be a story of consumption-led growth. That's the part that we don't see happening. When you stop accumulating capital so aggressively, the real demand for capital slows down, real productivity growth slows down, income growth slows down. So what you get is a mathematical rebalancing away from investment to consumption, but consumption growth itself will remain subdued. So you'll start seeing much lower rates of growth, which will be mathematically dominated by consumption. But China's footprint in the global economy is going to get much flatter and, for its own sake, much more stable. I think they're okay with that.
Die entscheidende Erkenntnis hier ist folgende. Wir haben gesehen, dass die chinesische Führung im Jahr 2015 erkannt hat, dass die Abhängigkeit von Kredit und von Schulden nicht positiv ist. Und sie hat entsprechend gehandelt. Sie hat Überkapazitäten in einigen Märkten, konkret wird die Stahlindustrie erwähnt, reduziert. Sie hat angefangen, Verschuldung abzubauen und vor allem hat sie auch angefangen, sich zu verabschieden von dem Mantra des hohen Wachstumsraten. Das heißt, die Erwartung, die hier formuliert wird, ist die, dass China in Zukunft weniger wachsen wird und dass der Anteil der Konsumwirtschaft zwar zunehmen wird, aber nicht, weil der Konsum so stark wächst, sondern weil wir generell auf einer langsameren Wachstumsrate uns bewegen werden. Aus Sicht der Weltwirtschaft würde ich jetzt hier ergänzen, ist Folgendes relevant. Wenn China entsprechende Überkapazitäten abbaut, dann ist natürlich auch der deflationäre Druck dieser Überkapazitäten für China, aber auch für die Welt geringer. Und das passt dann bereits in das übergeordnete Thema, nämlich zur Rückkehr der Inflation. Ich habe dann nochmal nachgefragt, warum denn die Sparquote der Chinesen so hoch ist und ob nicht das doch dafür sorgen würde, dass in Zukunft die Nachfrage höher wäre. Auch da gab es eine sehr interessante Antwort.
The savings rate have partly been a function of what they have been able to do with interest rates in the domestic economy. Because they were able to close off capital in the past, they were able to move massive amounts of household savings into state-owned enterprises. And if you look at the Chinese statistics, the biggest savings in there were on the corporate sector by state-owned enterprises. That story is now changing. And what you're seeing is that the private sector is actually hungry for funds. But because the level of leverage in the economy is so high, Chinese authorities cannot indulge in another round of leverage, even if it's going to more productive resources, because that would really threaten financial stability in the overall sense. So I think there is a change in the way the savings behavior will take place. They are giving more protection to household savings. There's a thirst on the private sector side and unlikely to be such a huge accumulation by state-owned enterprises.
Also es war so, offensichtlich lag die Sparquote nicht nur an den privaten Haushalten, sondern eben auch an den Staatsunternehmen, die entsprechend gespart haben, Schulden abgebaut haben. Das wird jetzt weiter passieren. Es ist zurzeit so, dass der Privatsektor teilweise Probleme hat, neue Mittel zu bekommen, einfach deshalb, weil die chinesische Regierung auf der Bremse bleibt beim Kreditwachstum. Und generell werden auch die Sparer besser geschützt. Auch das eigentlich eine positive Entwicklung. Und alles das bedeutet eben, dass wir geringere Wachstumsraten in China erleben werden. Dies liegt auch, wie Guthardt ergänzt, daran, dass eben auch in China die Alterung mit voller Wucht einsetzt.
Also the demographic factors will be shifting. In China, there's been virtually no social safety net, no public sector pensions and so on, which meant that during the period when the baby boomers like yourself were passing through, they were having to save a lot for their old age. As a shift into retirement, and the actual number of workers in China is now going to go down. There's going to be the shift into retirement of those who saved in the past. They will now have to dissave during their old age and retirement, and there are fewer young to actually do the saving. So demography is also going to have the effect of lowering the savings ratio.
Ein wichtiger Aspekt, der hier noch angeführt wird, nämlich das Thema, es gibt keine ausgebaute Sozialversicherung in China. Folge, die privaten Haushalte mussten fürs Alter vorsorgen, haben entsprechend viel gespart und diese privaten Haushalte gehen jetzt in das Rentenalter über. Das heißt, sie müssen ihre Ersparnisse aufbrauchen, um davon zu leben und auch das wird dazu führen, dass die Sparquote in China in den kommenden Jahren weiter sinkt. Nun haben wir es nichts mit einem Geschichtsbuch zu tun, sondern eigentlich mit einem Buch, welches Prognose machen möchte. Und deshalb war es für mich relevant zu fragen, ob wir nun wieder an einem solchen Wendepunkt sind wie vor 40 Jahren. Also damals, ich erinnere daran, 1980 ungefähr, hohe Inflationsraten, hohe Zinsen, um eben die Inflationsmentalität zu brechen und dann eben der Eintritt von Osteuropa und von China in die Weltmärkte. Nun haben wir genau das Gegenteil. Die Frage ist, was sind die Implikationen für die Zukunft und worauf müssen wir uns einstellen?
Viele schauen beim Trading zuerst auf die Strategie. Dabei wird oft vergessen, dass auch die Ausführung selbst einen Unterschied machen kann. Also, wie schnell wird ein Trade ausgeführt, wie eng sind die Spreads und wie direkt ist eigentlich der Marktzugang? Genau an dem Punkt setzt TradeGate Direct an. Die App richtet sich an aktive und erfahrene Trader, die bewusst handeln und mehr Kontrolle über ihre Orders haben möchten. Gehandelt wird direkt über die TradeGate BSX ohne externe Intermediäre zwischen Order und Börse. Gerade bei häufigerem Trading spielen Themen wie Liquidität, Spreads oder Slippage eine größere Rolle, als viele denken. Deshalb setzt TradeGate Direct auf transparente Ausführung, professionelle Ordertypen und tiefe Performance-Reportings, mit denen sich das eigene Trading detaillierter auswerten lässt. TradeGate Direct wurde bereits zweimal in Folge von Stiftung Warentest als Kostensieger ausgezeichnet. Dazu kommen lange Handelszeiten von 7.30 Uhr bis 22 Uhr und dauerhaft kostenfreies Trading. Marktübliche Spreads können natürlich anfallen. Hinter der Trading-App steht die Berliner TradeGate AG, ein Unternehmen mit über 30 Jahren Erfahrung im Finanzmarktbereich. Wenn Sie sich das anschauen möchten, unter tradegate.direct finden Sie alle Informationen zur App und den Funktionen. Den Link gibt's in den Shownotes.
Guthardt betont, dass der Wandel ja schon begonnen hat, und zwar vor ungefähr 10 Jahren.
The secular change in both demography and in globalization has already begun. That really started about 2010. The problem in terms of looking at inflation and interest rates is that these changes weakened the power of bargaining power of labor enormously. And both a symptom and a cause of this has been the decline in private sector trade unions and private sector trade union powers. And the trade unions used to have great political power, like the UAW in the US and the NUM in the UK, hardly exist any longer. So that the bargaining power of labor has been trashed, particularly with the shift from manufacturing to services, which is again part of the globalization story. So it will take quite a long time before the trends in underlying trends in globalization and demography and the decline in supply of labor relative to demand strengthen the overall bargaining power of labor sufficiently to bring about a generalized increase in inflationary pressures and unit wage costs.
Im Kern weist Guthardt darauf hin, dass im Prinzip wir ja jahrzehntelang eine Abnahme von Gewerkschaftsmacht gesehen haben, von Arbeitnehmermacht. Und obwohl sich die Tendenzen jetzt umdrehen, dauert es einfach sehr lange, bis sich diese Macht wieder aufbaut. Und deshalb sagt er, der demografische Wandel wird zweifellos die Arbeitnehmer wieder stärken und damit auch zu einem Anstieg der Löhne führen. Aber es dauert, bis wir das sehen, und es dauert dann auch, bis es sich in Inflationsraten niederschlägt. Das heißt, es ist eine Entwicklung, die schon läuft, die wir nur noch nicht wahrgenommen haben. Generell ist es mit dem Timing so ein Problem.
The greatest problem in all this is timing. I think we know that it will happen. The question has been when. And before the COVID pandemic, when asked when will the timing of the change in inflation and interest rates, et cetera, come about, we used to say that we really couldn't tell to within maybe 5 or 10 years. But we feel that the effect of the COVID pandemic is actually likely to speed things up for a number of reasons. And we think that there will be a short-term blip in inflation, that this may be strong enough to unhinge inflationary expectations, at least to some extent, that when inflationary expectations change, the underlying shift in the bargaining power of labor and the shift in supply may well occur rather faster than we had been previously thinking. And the key timing on this is not going to be this year or probably the beginning of next year, because central bankers will actually applaud some increase in inflation, as it will offset the undershoot of their targets that have occurred in the last few years. The question really will be, by the end of 2022 and the beginning of 2023, will inflation go back to the very low levels of the last few years, or will it stay considerably higher?
Also ich finde es interessant, dass auch hier Corona eine Rolle spielen soll, weil Guthardt weist darauf hin, dass im Prinzip wahrscheinlich die Politik im Zusammenhang mit Corona die bestehenden Tendenzen beschleunigen würde. Und er vermutet, dass deshalb Inflationsraten früher anziehen als ohne Corona. Und das wird sich seines Erachtens im kommenden Jahr erst zeigen, 2022. Vor allem dann, wenn wir sehen werden, ob die Notenbanken bereit sind, auf höhere Inflationsraten zu reagieren. Die Vermutung ist nein. Und dann könnte es durchaus sein, dass wir bereits im kommenden Jahr höhere Inflationsraten erleben und quasi das, was das Buch vorhersagt, entsprechend Realität wird. Es hat damit zu tun, dass wir es mit einer Art von Wettkampf zwischen zwei Schlüsseltheorien zum Thema Inflation zu tun haben.
What is particularly fascinating is that there are two key theories of the determination of inflation. The Friedman monetary theory, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and what you might describe as the Phillips curve theory, that is a function of the balance between demand and supply in output and labor markets. Never before have these two theories been in such opposition, with the monetary aggregates going at a dramatically fast rate at the moment, but the unemployment remaining quite high, likely to go higher in the next few months, and output really quite depressed. So it'll be quite fascinating to see which of these two key theories of inflation will come out on top in the next few years. And of course, we don't know. But never before have the two theories been so much in conflict.
Wir hatten ja Inflation auch bereits im Podcast früher und es gibt in der Tat zwei Theorien, die hinter Inflation stehen. Die eine ist die Geldtheorie, die Geldmengentheorie von Milton Friedman, der letztlich gesagt hat, wenn es zu viel Geld gibt, gibt es Inflation. Und demgegenüber gibt es die Theorie der Phillips-Kurve, die letztlich einen Zusammenhang zwischen der Auslastung der Wirtschaft, im Prinzip der Nachfrage nach Arbeitskräften und damit Lohnsteigerungen und Inflationsraten herstellt. Und Guthardt weist darauf hin, dass im Prinzip wir heute eine Situation haben, wo diese beiden Theorien sich entgegengesetzt stehen wie noch nie. Denn auf der einen Seite haben wir eine massive monetäre Expansion. Auf der anderen Seite haben wir natürlich auch Unterauslastung durch Corona, also Arbeitslosigkeit. Das eine sozusagen eher deflationär, das andere eher inflationär. Und wir werden in den kommenden Jahren sehen, welche dieser beiden Theorien sich durchsetzt. Es könnte natürlich auch sein, würde ich ergänzen, dass wir sehr schnell eine hohe Auslastung erleben und es dann eine gleichmäßige Entwicklung gibt von beiden getrieben, nämlich eine hohe Auslastung und eben die Geldmengen und beides zusammen dann die Inflationsraten nach oben treibt. Wir werden es, wie gesagt, sehen. Es ist in der Tat ein faszinierendes Thema. Und natürlich spielt in dem Zusammenhang auch die Entwicklung in den Finanzmärkten eine Rolle. Danach habe ich gefragt, ob wir nicht schon längst Inflation haben, nur eben in den Vermögenspreisen und nicht in den Preisen im Geschäft. Und auch dazu gab es eine klare Aussage.
I think that that must be a general worry that the very expansionary monetary policies over the last decade or so have been stoking up asset prices more or less everywhere, not only housing, but equities in particular, bonds already, to levels that are historically dangerous.
Also die Aussage ganz klar hier, die Vermögenspreise sind auf historisch hohem Niveau, auf gefährlichem Niveau. Und das ist natürlich die Folge der Geldpolitik der vergangenen Jahre. Also hier eine Einschätzung, die auch deckungsgleich ist mit dem, was Herr William White vor einigen Wochen an dieser Stelle gesagt hat. Es gibt es ja Kritiker, und zu denen gehöre ich da manchmal auch, also zumindest möchte ich die Fragen aufnehmen der Kritiker, die sagen, naja, wir haben doch eigentlich ein Vorbild für diese demografische Entwicklung, nämlich Japan. Japan ist uns ja mehrere Jahrzehnte voraus, die Erwerbsbevölkerung schrumpft, die Bevölkerung altert und wir sehen doch ganz offensichtlich, dass Japan nicht mit Inflation zu kämpfen hat, sondern mit Deflation. Also wieso sollte jetzt, wo die ganze Welt japanisch wird, wo Europa japanisch wird, wo die USA sich in die Richtung entwickeln, wo selbst China japanisch wird, wieso sollte jetzt Inflation kommen? Wir sehen doch, es ist deflationär. Und das fand ich sehr interessant, was mir da entgegengehalten wurde.
The point we were trying to make is that using Japan, which had, and that's perhaps the sense you were using it in, which is that we're going to see demographic trends turn our labor forces south, the growth rate. But the general economic effects that are associated with that decline in the labor force of Japan, we think have been misinterpreted. Our own interpretation is that what Japan went through was a rather unique combination of having a asset bust at home, which lasted about a decade. But beyond that, the effects that we see in Japan are not domestic origin necessarily. Because Japan started seeing its labor force declining at a time when China was effectively disinflating the entire world, and Japan had no way of stopping that disinflation in terms of inflation, in terms of interest rates at its borders. It's a very, very open economy. And actually, to the contrary of what most people think happened to the Japanese corporate sector, that it was very heavily burdened by the decline in leverage, that it was, you know, a very difficult time for them. Actually, if you go back and look at METI surveys for 20 years, what they show you is that the Japanese corporate sector was a profit-maximizing, robust, vibrant way of accessing this global labor supply shock that Charles talked about. They invested, they produced, they employed much more heavily in China, in North Asia, in Poland, in Brazil, anywhere where labor was cheap and easily available and getting integrated with the global economy. And they just decided that the domestic side of the story was not as profitable as this massive increasing labor supply. So they were taking advantage of the very factor that we think has been changing the shape of the global economy. The difference is that that really escape route is not available to anyone, with the effect that even the services sector in Japan today is investing heavily in productivity, which is something that they haven't had to do for the last 30 years.
Also Japan ist offensichtlich nicht das Vorbild für das, was kommt, sondern Japan hatte eine einmalige Situation. Sie hatten eine Asset-Blase. Wir wissen, 1989 ist die Blase geplatzt. Dann hatten sie 10 Jahre eine Anpassungskrise. Aber demgegenüber ist Japan der große Profiteur auch gewesen von der Globalisierung und vor allem vom Markteintritt Chinas. Sie haben dort und auch in Osteuropa im großen Stil Produktionskapazitäten aufgebaut, haben im Prinzip dort investiert, nicht in Japan investiert, haben dort, wo Arbeit billig ist oder war zumindest, entsprechend Kapazitäten aufgebaut und haben damit die eigene Profitabilität gesteigert. Und erst jetzt, wo sich eben abzeichnet, dass dieser Sondereffekt ausläuft, sind die Japaner bereit, mehr zu investieren und vor allem auch wieder mehr in Produktivität zu investieren, sogar im heimischen Service-Sektor. Das heißt, Japan ist eigentlich eher ein Beispiel für die These des Buches und nicht gegen die These des Buches. Und damit sind wir schon bei einem ganz wichtigen Aspekt, nämlich bei dem Thema der Notwendigkeit zur Produktivitätssteigerung. Immer wieder im Podcast ein Thema, aber sicherlich im Blick auf die vor uns liegende Entwicklung auch für Charles Guthardt und Manoj Pratan ein wichtiges Thema.
One of the key things to keep in mind is that I think the global demography dynamics that we're going to see in the future means that we really can't afford to have workers getting involved in tasks that are so repetitive that they can be done by a machine. We actually rather need robotics to get rid, especially in the advanced economies, of tasks that can be automated. Because one of the points we try to make is that what we cannot anticipate today is the coming demand for lower skilled labor to look after the elderly. What we need is to understand that what the projections that we are getting from the UN population statistics do not show how an increasing part of the labor force will be involved in what we call socially productive activities, but not economically productive activities, because the services they provide will be consumed by the elderly, who will not then go on to produce anything else. So the shortage of labor in that area that we will need to fill needs to come from somewhere. And if immigration is very difficult in the current political climate, then we absolutely need automation to reduce some of the jobs in other parts and allow that reallocation of labor to flow towards looking after the elderly.
Also macht hier einen ganz wichtigen Punkt bezüglich der Wirkung der alternden Gesellschaft auf die Nachfrage nach Arbeitskräften. Weil wir werden mehr Menschen brauchen, die sich eben um die Pflege und Versorgung von älteren Menschen kümmern. Und er sagt, letztlich können wir das nur so bewerkstelligen, dass wir in anderen Sektoren der Wirtschaft entsprechend die Produktivität durch Automatisierung, durch den Einsatz von Robotern steigern. Das heißt, wir werden überproportional produktiv in den anderen Sektoren, um Personal freizusetzen, um ungebildetes Personal auch freizusetzen für die Tätigkeit der Versorgung und der Pflege von alternden Menschen. Ich finde es sehr spannend. In meinem Buch habe ich übrigens ja ein bisschen anders argumentiert. Ich habe gesagt, wir sollten auch versuchen, im sozialen Bereich Produktivitätsreserven zu heben. Aber es leuchtet mir schon ein, dass sicherlich es sehr wenigen Menschen gefallen wird, so wie den Japanern, mit Robotern zu tun zu haben im Altersheim. Ich meine, in Japan, das ist meine Ergänzung noch, wird in der Tat daran gearbeitet, dass Roboter im Altersheim diese Tätigkeiten mit übernehmen. Ich glaube nicht, dass das weltweit eine große Zukunft haben wird. Vor dem Hintergrund in der Tat der Ansatz. Wir haben den hohen Druck, die Produktivität in vielen Bereichen zu steigern, um diese Aufgabe wahrnehmen zu können. Doch kommen wir zurück zu den makroökonomischen Implikationen. Die wichtige Frage, die immer gestellt wird, ist neben der Inflation natürlich auch die Frage, was wird der demografische Wandel für die Zinsentwicklung bedeuten? Wir kennen die Theorie, dass natürlich die Tatsache, dass so viele Menschen gespart haben fürs Alter, der Ersparnisüberhang, dass dieser Ersparnisüberhang dazu geführt hat, dass die Zinsen gesunken sind, dazu geführt hat, dass die Vermögenspreise gestiegen sind. Und wenn wir jetzt davon ausgehen, dass eben die Entwicklung der letzten 40 Jahre sich umdreht und wir wieder eine Zunahme haben der abhängigen Menschen, die von weniger erwerbstätigen Menschen ernährt werden müssen, dann muss das natürlich auch im Zusammenhang mit einem Entsparen der alternden Gesellschaft zu höherer Nachfrage nach Kapital oder gleichzeitig geringerem Angebot von Kapital durch Entsparen führen. Also schauen wir mal, was das Ganze für die Zinsentwicklung bedeutet.
We think that at any rate outside of the euro area, where the ECB is protected by treaty, there will be great pressure from the politicians on central banks to hold nominal interest rates very low, not to raise them as inflation starts coming back, which would mean that real interest rates at the short end would remain very low or perhaps even fall further, though the yield curve will, under these circumstances, steepen quite strongly, unless, of course, there's political pressure even further for yield curve control. And in either case, holding real interest rates down in this way, particularly with yield curve control, would add yet further to monetary growth and the likelihood that inflation would expand even faster. The only way, I'm afraid, in a square circle is that we could have considerably higher taxation. And one of the consequences of our projections is that in order to stabilize inflation, stabilize debt and deficits, at the same time as looking after the old reasonably generously, there is probably no alternative but considerably higher taxation. But that is so politically unpopular that that is one reason why we think that the political optimum in future decades will again be somewhat faster inflation. The nicest way to deal with debt is to grow out of it. But the point is that the slowdown in the growth of the number of workers means that growth will slow towards the Japanese level unless we have a productivity miracle. And we do think that productivity will rise as there is more onshoring instead of offshoring. And that in order to maintain profitability at home, businessmen will be forced to try to raise productivity to hold down new labor costs. But we doubt again whether productivity will rise sufficiently to enable growth even to maintain the relatively sluggish levels of the last decade.
Also die Zinsen werden also steigen, aber die Vermutung, die hier formuliert wird, ist, dass die Notenbanken sich dagegen stellen werden. Sie werden also versuchen, die Zinsen möglichst lange tief zu halten. Die Vermutung wird zwar geäußert, dass es für die Eurozone nicht zutrifft, da kommen wir gleich noch drauf, da habe ich nochmal nachgefragt. Aber im Prinzip die Aussage hier, die Notenbanken werden versuchen, die Zinsen tief zu halten. Sie werden versuchen, auch die Zinskurve zu definieren. Also Zinskurve wird es gemeint, das Verhältnis von Kurzfrist- und Langfristzinsen zu steuern und sozusagen nicht den Kapitalmärkten zu überlassen. Und all das wird natürlich dazu führen, dass die Inflationsrate noch mehr anzieht. Die Alternative zu höherer Inflation wäre eine deutlich höhere Besteuerung. Denn damit könnte man die Schulden stabilisieren, man könnte auch die Alten versorgen. Aber das ist politisch nicht unbedingt populär. Und deshalb glaubt eben Guthardt hier, dass die Politik am Ende sich eher für den inflationären Weg entscheiden wird. Am schönsten wäre es, und das wissen wir ja aus vergangenen Podcasts natürlich, wenn wir mehr Wachstum erzielen könnten. Doch auch hier ist er skeptisch, weil zum einen das geringere Wachstum der Erwerbsbevölkerung bzw. Schrumpfen der Erwerbsbevölkerung wie in Japan nur zu geringe Wachstumsraten zulässt und zum anderen die Produktivität zwar deutlich steigen wird, einfach deshalb, weil Personal und Arbeit teurer wird, aber sicherlich nicht in so einem erheblichen Maße, wie es nötig wäre, um alle Probleme zu lösen. Das heißt, Steuern wären die Alternative. Da sie vermutlich in dem Umfang nicht durchzusetzen sind, wird man eher den inflationären Weg gehen. Und dazu gehört eben auch, dass man versucht, die Zinsen möglichst lange unter dem eigentlich erforderlichen Niveau zu halten. Und die Kapitalmärkte, die scheinen das bereits zu ahnen. Sagt Manoj Pradhan.
If you look at markets themselves, I think there is a grudging willingness to at least think about inflation right now. There are two or three simple points to make here. Number one, the major concern that both Charles and I have is that the signal from the market needs to be taken with caution around structural turning points. So most people look at 10-year, 20-year, 30-year yields and they say, look, we're just not seeing any sign of inflation anywhere. But if you look at the mirror image of that in the 1980s, the 10-year, 20-year, and 30-year yields were telling you that interest rates would remain at 8 and 9% for the next few decades. And that was completely wrong. So using that is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy to be surely wrong if we turn out to have some credibility in our thesis. Second is, if you look at the break-even curve, which is the difference between nominal interest rates and inflation-linked bonds, that break-even inflation curve is showing you rates that are higher everywhere than nominal interest rates. So some of the things that Charles was mentioning that people might be considering that in this level of debt, a point that you made earlier, central banks cannot really allow yields to rise to compensate everyone for inflation, which means financial repression of a kind. That might already be something that the market is looking at more seriously. But the biggest issue, where you're right, is that if you start allowing interest rates to rise because inflation is rising, the effect on financial stability, not just in equity prices, but also in the borrowing binge that we have undertaken in government finance and in housing, they are certainly at risk. And we have a very difficult task ahead of us, which I think central banks will really have to work hard to earn their salaries.
Es ist scheinbar für die Kapitalmärkte natürlich schwer, Wendepunkte zu erkennen. Also er erklärt, wie eben in den 80er Jahren die Erwartung war, dass die Zinsen ewig so hoch bleiben würden bei 10% und mehr. Das blieben sie ja bekanntermaßen nicht. Und wie man heute sicherlich leichter zu kommen kann und kann sagen könnte, ja, die Zinsen bleiben ewig tief. Aber er sagt oder er weist darauf hin, dass die Differenz zwischen den sogenannten inflationsindizierten Anleihen oder den normalen Anleihen bereits darauf hindeutet, dass die Kapitalmärkte anfangen, davon auszugehen, dass in Zukunft die Inflationsrate höher liegen könnte. Und dies auch, weil ja nicht nur wir hier dem Podcast die Einzigen sind, die wissen, was passiert, sondern eben viele auch sehen, dass die Notenbanken letztlich angesichts der hohen Verschuldung und angesichts der Vermögenspreise in dem Dilemma sind, dass sie die Zinsen nicht steigen lassen können, wenn sie nicht sofort ein Problem mit der Finanzstabilität haben wollen. Das heißt, sie sind eigentlich dazu verdammt, die Zinsen tiefer zu halten aus Gründen der Finanzstabilität, damit aber die Grundlage zu legen für höhere Inflationsraten. Und das Problem in dem ganzen Zusammenhang ist, auch aus Sicht von Charles Guthardt, dass eben die Notenbanken sich überschätzen. Gerade eben haben wir schon gehört, nach dem Motto, naja, die Notenbanken haben eine schwere Aufgabe vor sich in den kommenden Jahren. Das stimmt, aber vor allem laufen sie Gefahr, ihre eigenen Möglichkeiten und ihre eigene Fähigkeit, die Inflation zu steuern, zu überschätzen.
One of my concerns is that there are some in the central banking fraternity who say, don't worry, even if inflation might come back, we know how to deal with it. And I think that that is horribly complacent. The reason I think that it's horribly complacent is that the effort and courage that Volcker had to show in 1979, 80, 81, and Reagan as well, was really quite remarkable. And the amount of debt, both public and private, at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s was probably not more than about a third in relationship to GDP of the level now. So if there were problems of financial stability, and remember that the Volcker shift in 79 led to the Mexican, Argentinian, and Brazilian crisis, which was the most severe financial crisis, really, of the post-war period, up until the great financial crisis itself. And in that period, virtually all the major city center banks in New York and elsewhere were actually on a mark-to-market basis, they were insolvent. So that it was a period of great financial danger, 1979, 1982. And the underlying situation now, because of the greater debt and the greater leverage around, is much, much worse. So that the idea that if inflation should rise, it's not going to be difficult to hit it on the head again, when I hear that, I feel it is wildly and dangerously complacent.
Tja, die Notenbanken also überoptimistisch bezüglich ihrer Fähigkeiten, mit Inflation umzugehen. Er weist halt darauf hin, dass sobald Inflation hoch ist, dass man dann eben mit harten Maßnahmen eingreifen muss, mit starken Zinserhöhungen, heißt es übersetzt. Und das hat immer negative Nebenwirkungen. Und zwar damals schon, vor 40 Jahren, als hat es zu Finanzkrisen geführt. Man denkt an die Mexiko-Krise, wo, so die Aussage, die meisten Banken in New York eigentlich pleite gewesen sind. Das heißt, wenn man anfängt, in einer hochverschuldeten Welt wie heute das zu machen, sind die Risiken noch viel größer und diese werden von den Notenbanken entsprechend unterschätzt. Übersetzt für mich heißt das, die Gefahr, dass die Inflationsrate eben schneller steigt und vor allem mehr außer Kontrolle gerät, als die Notenbanken es einräumen, ist deutlich höher als allgemein gesehen. Einfach aufgrund der Tatsache, dass wir uns gar nicht mehr leisten können, höhere Zinsen zu haben wegen der hohen Verschuldung. Ich habe dann noch gefragt, wieso er zu der Aussage gekommen ist, dass die Eurozone stabiler wäre als die anderen Währungsräume. Denn die Eurozone ist ja bekanntermaßen auch mit hohen Schulden versehen und die Notenbank interveniert entsprechend. Insofern war die Frage da, ob nicht der Euro in so einem Szenario, wo die anderen eben Inflationsraten zulassen und die Zinsen tief halten, ob dann der Euro nicht aufwerten würde, was die Probleme hierzulande oder in der Eurozone generell erhöhen würde. Und da kam eben die Antwort, dass er sagt, naja, die Amerikaner beginnen bereits viel aggressiver zu sein und der Euro wertet bereits auf.
I think that the point that you're making is already starting. It's already the case that the US is much more expansionary, both fiscal and monetarily, than the Eurozone on both fronts. That means that the euro has been appreciating, and that's another problem with the eurozone. So that the eurozone is much more likely to have price stability, but is much less likely to have much growth over the next few years than the US. There is the really polar distinction between the two. So what you point out is already in motion. The question then is, if that situation is not sustainable, what gives? How does what is not sustainable, how does that play out?
Also die Entwicklung ist schon da. Die Amerikaner sind viel aggressiver als die Europäer. Die Spannungen werden zunehmen. Es ist nicht sustainable. Da haben wir auch Konsens gehabt im Gespräch. Die große Frage ist natürlich, wie löst es sich auf? Die Frage blieb offen. Wir können davon ausgehen, dass ich glauben würde, dass die Europäer gezwungen sein werden, denselben Weg einzuschlagen wie die Amerikaner. Und dass nicht wenige in Europa, auch gerade wenige Politiker in Europa, froh sein werden, dass die Europäische Zentralbank denselben Weg wird einschlagen müssen. Ich habe dann natürlich gefragt, was wir denn tun sollten, um eine Krise zu verhindern. Eine Krise ausgelöst durch zu hohe Schulden, die Notwendigkeit, die Zinsen tief zu halten und das vor dem Hintergrund des Szenarios einer rückkehrenden Inflation.
It's not going to be easy. And I think one of the things that we have to do, and fairly quickly, is to think what additional forms of taxation will help to stabilize the fiscal position for the public sector and have the minimal effect on growth, on economic distortions and on social attitudes towards fairness. If we're going to avoid inflation, I think we're going to have much higher taxation. The question is, what kinds of taxation? How do we bring them in? Can you politically bring in higher taxation at a time when the mainstream is saying, don't worry about debt, don't worry about deficits, interest rates are going to remain low forever, the problems, underlying problems of demography are for another decade, let's close our eyes and plow on regardless. I think at the very least, those in power ought to be thinking about what tax rates need to be increased, how and when.
Die Antwort ist erneut, wenn wir die Krise verhindern wollen, müssten wir in der Tat höher besteuern. Wir müssen aber so höher besteuern, dass das Wachstum nicht hemmt, dass es Investitionen nicht hemmt und dass es als gerecht empfunden wird. Und es klingt durch, dass die Hoffnung, dass die Politik diesen Weg beschreiten wird, nicht besonders ausgeprägt ist. Einfach deshalb, weil man auch sagen kann, naja, es dauert ja noch 10 Jahre, bis die Demografie zuschlägt, richtig? Und wir haben doch gerade sehr tiefe Zinsen, wir können es doch hoch verschulden. Und der Mainstream, wie es so schön formuliert wird, der ist ja dafür zu sagen, lasst uns doch mehr Schulden machen, die Schulden spielen keine Rolle. Ein Fehler, Charles Goodhart wäre für eine höhere Besteuerung, aber die Frage ist, ob das wirklich kommen wird. Politiker sollten darüber nachdenken, seiner Ansicht nach. Ich würde vielleicht ergänzen, dass natürlich in Deutschland das Thema ein bisschen anders ist, nachdem bei uns eben die Verschuldung eine deutlich tiefere ist als in anderen Ländern. Und vor dem Hintergrund sollten wir immer unsere Politik natürlich immer abstimmen im Kontext der Eurozone. Auch das war schon Thema des Öfteren in diesem Podcast. Doch blicken wir nach vorne. Es muss ja nicht alles schlecht sein. Und Manoj Pradhan betont eben, dass wir nicht sagen sollten, alles wird schlecht sein in den kommenden Jahren. Im Gegenteil, die Entwicklung, die vor uns liegt, hat auch durchaus positive Seiten.
Not everyone would be unhappy with what we're saying, because if you look at some of the administrations that have either come into place or some of the social issues we've dealt with, one of the serious problems we've had is inequality. So part of the story that we are talking about is that inequality will fall within countries, which has been very difficult for anyone to solve. And the second is that the labor increase in labor bargaining power will allow them to accrue a little bit more of the growth and purchasing power for themselves in the future by getting some kind of after-tax increases in wages, which will compensate them for inflation. So it's not all bad news. I think the primary problem that seems to be the case is in the last 30 years, we had fantastic growth in financial market conditions at the expense of this social issue, which came into a head really after the great financial crisis. But if that's going to move some of the other way, it's partial compensation in a social sense for the loss of economic momentum, for this change in the growth mix. And partly policymakers, if you look at the statements coming out of the Federal Reserve from the European Central Bank, they are paying far more attention to ESG issues, to issues of social importance. And that may be something that does help mitigate some of the issues that will come up on the economic and financial side. It's possible.
Also der positive Ausblick ist, die Umkehrung einiger Entwicklungen hat ja Vorteile. Wir werden eine Abnahme haben der Ungleichheit, wir werden steigende Reallöhne, Nachsteuerreallöhne haben für die Arbeitnehmer aufgrund der steigenden Macht, die die Arbeitnehmer wieder haben aufgrund der demografischen Entwicklung. Realwirtschaft wird wieder mehr an Bedeutung gewinnen, verglichen mit den Finanzmärkten. Also alles das eigentlich ein positives Bild, was man malen kann für die kommenden Jahre. Und darüber sollten wir uns auch freuen. Die Frage wird natürlich sein, wie der Übergang sich darstellt von heute zu morgen. Und das wird sicherlich nicht ganz friktionslos ablaufen. Doch bevor wir dazu kommen, war meine Frage an die beiden, was denn so sein wird, wenn man in 40 Jahren zurückblickt, so wie ich jetzt festgestellt habe, dass ich vor 40 Jahren nicht richtig erwartet habe, was kommt. Was sollte ich denn jetzt für die kommenden 40 Jahre erwarten? Wie können wir uns darauf einstellen? Was wird das Umfeld sein?
And to be honest, Daniel, you can't look forward 40 years. And the idea that you can have any kind of sensible, let alone rational, expectations about what the world will look like in 2060, I don't think that you can do this. I think that our point is that over the next 25 years, we're going to find a restoration of the kind of problems that we had in the 1970s, and in many ways worse, because for reasons that were straightforward at the time. We have run such low interest rate policies that we're entering the next 25 years with an enormous accumulation of debt. And that is going to make the next 25 years, with the reversal of the beneficial effects of globalization and demography on our economies, it's going to be a great deal harder, and the problems of policy are going to become much more severe, particularly for central banks, than they have been in the last 30 years since we got central bank independence in 1990. I've said in public in several times that the last 30 years were the glory years of central banking, and they were very enjoyable for central banks. The next 30 years are going to be extremely more difficult.
Also 40 Jahre wollte er sich nicht festlegen, aber er meinte, die kommenden 25 Jahre werden sehr ähnlich sein wie die 70er Jahre. Die Probleme werden zurückkommen, also schwaches Wachstum, eher Inflation. Aber der große Unterschied erneut ist die deutlich höhere Schuldenlast. Und diese Schuldenlast, getrieben durch das billige Geld, wird es viel schwerer machen, als in den 70er Jahren damit umzugehen. Und dann verbunden wird natürlich auch der Nimbus der Notenbanken leiden. Waren die letzten 30 Jahre für die Notenbanken die glorreichen 30 Jahre, so kann man jetzt davon ausgehen, dass es in Zukunft für die Notenbanken deutlich schwerer sein wird, einen guten Ruf zu bewahren. Und Pradhan ergänzt, dass er glaubt, dass es eher eine 4- bis 5-Jahresperiode geben wird, in dem das alte bisherige Gleichgewicht beendet wird und ein neues entsteht.
I think it will be a 4- to 5-year period in which the old equilibrium is shocked out of its complacency and into a new one. And once that new equilibrium happens, we will see much more action by policymakers and so on and so forth, which could mitigate some of the effects we are talking about. But I think the point we would try to bring forward is a lot of the things that we are saying might happen could be the trigger that jolts people into doing the things that they have to do. But it'll be a very difficult period, probably half a decade or so, going and changing our perspectives.
Also 4 bis 5 schwere Jahre liegen vor uns, um zu diesem neuen Gleichgewicht zu kommen. Vor allem deshalb, weil wir eben Themen angreifen müssen, die wir schon seit Jahren hätten angreifen müssen und eben uns drum herum gedrückt haben. Das ist die Erwartung, die hier formuliert wird. Für mich ist viel entscheidender, wir haben in der Tat es zu tun mit einer fundamentalen Analyse der Vergangenheit, in der Bedeutung von Demografie für Zins, für Inflation und damit nicht nur ein Blick auf die Vergangenheit, sondern eben auch zumindest eine, wie ich finde, gut fundierte Theorie, was in Zukunft auf uns zukommt.
Soweit die Highlights. Wie gesagt, am Ende des Podcasts folgt dann das komplette Originalgespräch. Was sind meine Schlussfolgerungen aus diesem Gespräch? Erstens, Charles Goodhart und Manoj Pradhan hatten recht. 2020 war die These sicherlich eine Minderheitsposition. Heute ist klar, dass die Demografie-These wahrscheinlich besser erklärt, was passiert, als die damals gültige Stagnationsthese, die vor allem von Larry Summers und Olivier Ponchard vertreten wurde, nach dem Motto, wir werden nie wieder Zinsen sehen. Zweitens, Deutschland steht nicht besser da als andere. Im Gegenteil. Deutschland dürfte demografisch das am stärksten betroffene Land sein in Europa nach Italien. Wir haben eine Babyboomer-Kohorte mit fast 1 Million Geburten pro Jahr in den 1960er Jahren, gefolgt von Geburtenknick der 70er und einer stabil niedrigen Geburtenrate seit den 90ern. Jetzt gehen die Babyboomer in den Ruhestand und die Folgen sind fiskalisch, aber auch am Arbeitsmarkt bald zu spüren. Drittens, Deutschland, wie auch die anderen Länder, reagieren natürlich völlig falsch. Wir wissen es. Das Rentenpaket, welches die Bundesregierung im Dezember 2025 beschlossen hat, ist im Prinzip, wie soll man es eigentlich nennen, Realitätsverleugnung pur. Man tut so, als könnte man einfach weitermachen wie bisher, obwohl jetzt genau der demografische Bruch ins Haus steht. Viertens, die Geldpolitik ist gefangen. Das ist ganz klar. Die Refinanzierung der Staaten, die Solvenz der Staaten wird über die Geldwertstabilität gestellt. Nebenwirkung, die Inflation hilft auch dabei, die Verschuldung relativ zum nominal aufgeblähten Bruttoinlandsprodukt zu senken. Fünftens, künstliche Intelligenz dürfte keine Rettung sein. Man geht immer davon aus, dass KI quasi einen positiven Angebotsschock, ähnlich dem Marktrücktritt von China in den 1990er Jahren, liefern könnte. Charles Goodhart macht das in seinem Interview mit der FT relativ klar. Kurzfristig wirkt KI durch den Investitionsbedarf in Rechenzentren und für Energieversorgung inflationär, nicht deflationär. Und selbst wenn KI langfristig deflationär wirken sollte, wird der Effekt nicht ausreichen, um die demografischen Ausgaben zu kompensieren. Der wichtigere technologische Faktor, so Goodhart, wäre nicht KI, sondern die medizinische Behandlung von Demenz. Beobachtung 6. Die politischen Konsequenzen. Ich denke, wir bräuchten dringend eine ehrliche Diskussion zu vier Punkten. Erstens, längere Lebensarbeitszeit statt fester Renteneintrittsalter. Wir sehen ja bereits, wie schwierig die Diskussion ist. Zweitens, Anpassung des Rentenniveaus an die Beitragskohorten, jeweils relativ zu dem, was man quasi hat. Als Beitragskohorten kann man auch nur auszahlen. Drittens, Reform der Beamtenpensionen. Das ist klar, die Beamtenpensionen sind viel zu hoch. Viertens, gezielte Fachkräftezuwanderung. Wir wissen, unsere Migrationspolitik ist nicht geeignet, die Renten sicher zu machen, im Gegensatz zu dem, was der eine oder andere Ökonom zum Höhepunkt der Flüchtlingskrise behauptet hat. Wir brauchen eine Migrationspolitik, die es attraktiv macht, für Fachkräfte aus Deutschland zu kommen. Das bedeutet übrigens auch, wir brauchen eine Politik, die es für Fachkräfte attraktiv macht, in Deutschland zu bleiben. Soweit meine Gedanken zum Gespräch mit Charles Goodhart und Manoj Pradhan aus dem Jahr 2021. Nun, am Ende des Podcasts, wie gesagt, das gesamte Gespräch, was sich lohnt, in voller Länge im Original. Bleibt mir an dieser Stelle Ihnen sehr herzlich erneut fürs Zuhören zu danken. Ich freue mich auf Fragen, Feedback, Kritik und Anregungen und auf ein Wiederhören am kommenden Sonntag, wo wir Stand jetzt über einen anderen Aspekt der letzten 30 Jahre sprechen werden, nämlich über die Vermögenspreisinflation und die Frage, wie es da weitergehen wird. Ich denke, auch das ist spannend und ich freue mich, wenn wir kommenden Sonntag wieder mit dabei sind. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen eine schöne Zeit, genießen den Sommer, Ihr Daniel Stelter. Und jetzt das ganze Gespräch im Original.
Dear Charles, dear Manoj, thank you very much for joining my podcast. Welcome to my show.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Actually, I read your book and I would like to start with my personal experience. Look, I'm now close to 57. And when I look back to my interest in economics and my interest in financial markets, I have experienced 40 very interesting years because interest rates came down. My first bond I ever bought yielded 10% in Germany. And now I get negative rates. And when I look back, there was quite high inflation rates still 40 years back. Now we have no inflation. And we have extremely high asset prices. We have high debt levels. So what's been happening in the past 40 years? What's been the reason why we had this could we have expected it? Was I just stupid not seeing what's going to happen? So what happened the past 40 years leading to such a result?
Well, it's really longer than 40 years you ought to take consideration of. The last 70 years have been really quite dramatically different from what happened before then. Before 1950, prices, inflationary expectations, and long-term interest rates remained fairly stable, except during wartime, and particularly in the aftermath of big wars. Otherwise, apart from wartime, there was a great deal of monetary stability. Then from about 1950 onwards, for the next three decades, there was a steady increase in inflation, in expectations of inflation, and in nominal interest rates. That peaked at the end of the 70s, when Paul Volcker, with the support of Ronald Reagan, and in the UK, Maggie Thatcher, and Bundesbank in Germany, all succeeded in beating inflation. It was actually a quite difficult exercise, more difficult than those now in office actually remember clearly. And then, as you say, for the next 40 years from 1980 until the current level, the current period, interest rates, inflation, inflationary expectations have all come down. Now, in some large part, all this has been due to improved monetary regimes. We had the gold standard pretty much up to the ending of Bretton Woods. And after that, what occurred was that the powers that be, the authorities at the time, whose main memory was about the Great Depression and the massive unemployment, found that they had command over the ability to control demand levels through Keynesian fiscal demand management, and they used it in the attempt to hold unemployment below its natural rate. And they didn't realize how this would feed back into ever-increasing inflation. And by the time they realized that, it was actually very difficult to beat inflation without introducing very considerable unemployment. So it took a lot of courage to turn the situation around. And after that, we got improved monetary policy regimes with central bank independence and inflation targetry. But one of the points that we make in our book is that although a great deal of the return to low and stable inflation was due to better monetary regimes, it was also due to a background which was actually increasingly disinflationary, and that was largely due to globalization bringing about a huge increase in the availability of labor to those who could move their employment from high to low-wage economies, and to demographic forces leading to a very sharp increase, not only in the working age population, but in the proportion of that population who were actual workers, as the reduction in the birth rate and other factors led to a very considerable increase in the participation of women in the number of those actually at work. Their participation increased very sharply.
So basically what you say is we had Bretton Woods. During Bretton Woods, we had reasonably stable prices. Then Bretton Woods was given up, also due to Vietnam, and then we had the inflation. And then you said, okay, it was first, it was a change in monetary policy. So it was basically Milton Friedman, I would assume, Milton Friedman theory saying, you know, we have limits the number, the growth rate of money in order to stabilize prices. And then after that, we had this demographic impact, because I remember, you know, I was born in 1964, and it was the highest number of childbirths ever in Germany. It was a booming. We were always many. I remember it was always many. Kindergarten, school, university, it was always many people. This has clearly changed. So you say there was a supply of young people in the Western world, but you also add to this the supply coming from China and Eastern Europe into the world markets.
I would add that I think the story that Charles was telling is absolutely critical, but what we have highlighted in the book also is absolutely the role of China and Eastern Europe. And more specifically to your point, I think the expectation that China would deliver the kind of integration and performance that it has, that was truly an unexpected part, because if you look at China's regime change, it started in the late 80s, in 1979 to be precise. But from 1979 to 1990, no one really worried that much about the rise of China. They saw it as a benign force. It's really only in the last 30, 35 years that the integration of its labor force into the global economy has changed everything and really supercharged the story to an extent that that's actually the first chapter in our book. We give it so much importance. And from an expectations point of view, that really set the cat among the
pigeons. So what is it? Yeah, Charles?
In 1990, China's share of exports in world trade was below 5%. By now, it's well above 25% and rising to about 30%. And the story of the rise of China is the most dramatic and most important development or economic development of the last 30 years.
So we had basically an increase in supply of labor, but also in production supply. We got labor, most probably wage pressure in the West, most probably due to this. But you also mentioned the role of the central banks. And I would like just to ask on the central banks, because in the beginning, I understand Volcker and Breaking's inflation mentality, I get it. But later on, many people, and I spoke with William White a few weeks back, later on, probably central banks, he said it this way, he said central banks were fighting the deflationary impact of China not reading it correctly, but saying, you know, it's dangerous and not accepting it as being normal just because of the supply chain. Would you say that central banks played a good role, or did it play a role what they did? Or did they probably made a mistake in the past 20 years of not being a bit more restrictive in spite of having the low prices or the deflationary pressure from China?
It was a very quick development, which hadn't, as Manoj says, been widely expected at all. And with the enormous benefit of hindsight, I think that it would have been much better if the inflation target had been set at zero rather than 2%. But that is with the benefit of hindsight. And if you were sitting, as I was actually in New Zealand, when they were introducing the first inflation target at the end of the 1980s, we couldn't foresee the role of China. And at that time, I think 2% was actually about the right level to set it. And once it had been set, prior to the impact of China on the world economy at 2%, there were very good reasons for not changing what you had initially done. You start monkeying around with an inflation target, people will lose confidence in it and say they will always change it to whatever currently suits the political pressures of the moment. So I think what happened, in a sense, was inevitable. And I think that once the inflation target had been set at 2%, what followed was actually, it wasn't too bad. And if you take the period of the inflation targetry from 1991 up to the great financial crisis in 2007, 16 years, those were the best 16 years in the economic history of the world ever, by a long way. Poverty went down dramatically. Unemployment remained quite slow. Inflation was very low and stable at the target level. And there were problems about inequality growing within the advanced economies, and that was a problem. But apart from that, those 16 years of the Great Moderation were historically an absolutely wonderful period. And in some large part, we have to thank central banks for that. But with the benefit of hindsight, it would have been better if we'd gone for zero rather than two.
Some people would say, well, yes, China was a supply shock on the labor market, but it was also contributing to the so-called savings glut, you know, the oversupply of savings. And Germany as well did this as well. And I think Larry Summers would then say, well, this was one of the reasons for low interest rates, and this was one of the reasons also causing the financial crisis. Would you see a link here? Was the price we had to pay for the 16, 17 great years, the financial crisis, just because it led to too low interest and too much speculation?
There was another factor as well. There was a degree of complacency that the private sector would always organize their own affairs in such a way as to avoid default and crises. And the sort of the Alan Greenspan hypothesis that you could rely on the private sector to manage its own affairs so as to maintain financial stability. And that concept turned out to be very mistaken. I've never seen anyone's reputation go from hero to zero in about as fast a short period of time as happened for Alan.
One small thing to add to that, I think one of the issues also with the development of China is that the way China was structured for such a huge economy was very different from the Western societies and economies, in the sense that you could access China's economy if you wanted to invest physical capital in there, but you were not really allowed to access China's market. So what they did with what is commonly known as the impossible trinity was they stopped capital flows at their doorstep. And that gave Chinese monetary and fiscal authorities a huge amount of control within the domestic economy, to transfer, if you will, in a sense, funds over from the household sector to the banks and then to the state-owned enterprises. And if you wanted to access China's economy, then you had to go and invest physically in the Pearl River Delta or in other parts of China. Now, what that meant was you get this massive flow of capital, which plays into what Charles was saying and plays into these huge inflows of capital, which were then pulled back to some extent. But I think that the broader issue was that the massive increase in the integration of China was supercharged by this policy, in the sense that if you had a completely open system of everything, perhaps the rates of return could have been equalized, and then you would not have been able to take Chinese local savings and allow the Chinese corporate sector to grow so aggressively. But because they could do that, they could make sure that the investment combined with the local cheap labor in such an aggressive fashion that the integration of the Chinese labor into the global economy was massive. I think I would say that that was the overriding concern, but factor that led to the disinflation that we've seen.
But some critics say, well, the Chinese economy is also depending on high debt levels. They have very high internal debt levels. They are creating overcapacities. They continue to create overcapacity. Whenever there's a crisis, they increase infrastructure spending and real estate spending in China. Is this something you would share? Or would you say, no, it's basically just a normal development and we should not rate it too highly?
Well, that penny has actually dropped in 2015. I think before 2015, there was a lot of optimism on the part of Chinese policymakers that growth would rise from 9.5 to 10, and then from 8 to 9, and then 7 to 8. And I think around 2015, the penny dropped after the domestic crash that they had at home. And since then, they have actually destroyed a huge amount of capacity in places like steel and other places where they had massive deflationary pressures building up. So they have fully realized that a lot of the physical capacity that they've built up and the debt that went to finance those capacities are going to produce no returns. And so if you can see the way they're trying to solve this problem is they have now released the state-owned enterprises from the role of being the primary drivers of investment. They're trying to get the private sector more involved, and to a large extent, they have succeeded in this. Not fully, because profitability still remains an issue. But I think the debt level story has been well understood and well absorbed, and they're trying to solve that with debt to equity swaps. It's not an easy story. But the bigger concern, as far as expectations is concerned, is that people still think that China is going to be a story of consumption-led growth. But that's the part that we don't see happening. When you stop accumulating capital so aggressively, the real demand for capital slows down, real productivity growth slows down, income growth slows down. So what you get is a mathematical rebalancing away from investment to consumption. But consumption growth itself will remain subdued. So you will start seeing much lower rates of growth, which will be mathematically dominated by consumption. But China's footprint in the global economy is going to get much flatter and, for its own sake, much more stable. I think they're okay with that.
I always read that the Chinese have a very high saving rates, so something like 30% or whatever. You would say, well, a lower saving rate is not going to change this picture, that it's going to lead to lower growth rates, dominated them by consumption, but still lower growth rates, or so they reduce the saving rate.
Well, the savings rate have partly been a function of what they have been able to do with interest rates in the domestic economy. Because they were able to close off capital in the past, they were able to move massive amounts of household savings into state-owned enterprises. And if you look at the Chinese statistics, the biggest savings in there were on the corporate sector by state-owned enterprises. That story is now changing, and what you're seeing is that the private sector is actually hungry for funds. Mm-hmm. But because the level of leverage in the economy is so high, Chinese authorities cannot indulge in another round of leverage, even if it's going to more productive resources, because that would really threaten financial stability in the overall sense. Yeah. So I think there is a change in the way the savings behavior will take place. They are giving more protection to household savings. There's a thirst on the private sector side and unlikely to be such a huge accumulation by state-owned enterprises.
Also, the demographic factors will be shifting. In China, there's been virtually no social safety net, no public sector pensions, and so on, which meant that during the period when the baby boomers, like yourself, were passing through, they were having to save a lot for their old age. As they shift into retirement, And the actual number of workers in China is now going to go down. There's going to be the shift in the retirement of those who saved in the past. They will now have to dissave during their old age and retirement, and there are fewer young to actually do the saving. So demography is also going to have the effect of lowering the savings ratio.
I understand. So if I now look at my personal situation, I just say, okay, you know, 40 years back or 35 years back, I didn't see what was coming because I underestimated the demographic impact. And now, obviously, your book is not a history book. I think your book is more about what we have to expect in the coming years, which is much more interesting, which is also more interesting to the listeners to my podcast. Are we now at another inflection point? Are we now going to see another secular change? Because you already spoke about demographics in China. We know the demographics in Europe. Europe, the workforce is about to shrink. We all follow Japanese path. Are we now at the beginning of a secular change in different direction? And what will be the implications?
The secular change in both demography and in globalization has already begun. That really started about 2010. The problem in terms of looking at inflation and interest rates is that these changes weakened the power of bargaining power of labor enormously. And both a symptom and a cause of this has been the decline in private sector trade unions and private sector trade union powers. Mm. And the trade unions that used to have great political power, like the UAW in the US and the NUM in the UK, hardly exist any longer. So that the bargaining power of labor has been trashed, particularly with the shift from manufacturing to services, which is again part of the globalization story. So it will take quite a long time before the trends in underlying trends in globalization and demography and the decline in supply of labor relative to demand strengthen the overall bargaining power of labor sufficiently to bring about a generalized increase in inflationary pressures and unit wage costs. And the greatest problem in all of this is timing. I think we know that it will happen. The question has been when. And before the COVID pandemic, when asked when will the timing of the change in inflation and interest rates, etc., come about, we used to say that we really couldn't tell to within maybe 5 or 10 years. But we feel that the effect of the COVID pandemic is actually likely to speed things up for a number of reasons. And we think that there will be a short-term blip in inflation, that this may be strong enough to unhinge inflationary expectations, at least to some extent, that when inflationary expectations change, the underlying shift in the bargaining power of labor and the shift in supply may well occur rather faster than we'd been previously thinking. And the key timing on this is not going to be this year or probably the beginning of next year, because central bankers will actually applaud some increase in inflation as it will offset the undershoot of their targets that have occurred in the last few years. The question really will be, by the end of 2022 and the beginning of 2023, will inflation go back to the very low levels of the last few years, or will it stay considerably higher? That's going to be when we find out. And what is particularly fascinating is that there are two key theories of the determination of inflation. The Friedman monetary theory, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and what you might describe as the Phillips curve theory, that is a function of this balance between demand and supply in output and labor markets. Never before have these two theories been in such opposition, with the monetary aggregates going at a dramatically fast rate at the moment, but the unemployment remaining quite high, likely to go higher in the next few months, and output really quite depressed. So it'll be quite fascinating to see which of these two key theories of inflation will come out on top in the next few years. And of course, we don't know. But never before have the two theories been so much in conflict.
We could say, well, we have an inflation in the asset prices, or wouldn't you say so?
We do indeed. And again, I think that in many ways, it's a pity that asset prices, particularly and most importantly, housing prices, are not included to a greater extent in the measure of inflation that is used for the inflation targets. And I think that that must be a general worry that the very expansionary monetary policies over the last decade or so have been stoking up asset prices more or less everywhere, not only housing, but equities in particular, bonds already, to levels that are historically dangerous.
Manoj, you wanted to make a contribution?
Yeah, I wanted to add one small point, which I think you mentioned fleetingly, but it caught my attention. And I wanted to flag a little bit of concern about this phrase, I think, which we generally take for granted, which says we're turning Japanese. Actually, one of the things we have tried to stress in the book is that we aren't, to the extent that even Japan isn't. So the point we were trying to make is that using Japan, which had, and that's perhaps the sense you were using it in, which is that we're going to see demographic trends turn our labor forces south, the growth rate. But the general economic effects that are associated with that decline in the labor force of Japan, we think have been misinterpreted. Our own interpretation is that what Japan went through was a rather unique combination of having a asset bust at home, which lasted about a decade. But beyond that, the effects that we see in Japan are not domestic origin necessarily. Because Japan started seeing its labor force declining at a time when China was effectively disinflating the entire world, and Japan had no way of stopping that disinflation in terms of inflation, in terms of interest rates at its borders. It's a very, very open economy. And actually, to the contrary of what most people think happened to the Japanese corporate sector, that it was very heavily burdened by the decline in leverage, that it was a very difficult time for them. Actually, if you go back and look at METI surveys for 20 years, what they show you is that the Japanese corporate sector was a profit-maximizing, robust, vibrant way of accessing this global labor supply shock that Charles talked about. They invested, they produced, they employed much more heavily in China, in North Asia, in Poland, in Brazil. Anywhere where labor was cheap and easily available and getting integrated with the global economy. And they just decided that the domestic side of the story was not as profitable as this massive increasing labor supply. So they were taking advantage of the very factor that we think has been changing the shape of the global economy. The difference is that that really escape route is not available to anyone, with the effect that even the services sector in Japan today is investing heavily in productivity, which is something that they haven't had to do for the last 30 years.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about Japan because I know, by the way, that the productivity per employee in Japan has been growing the fastest of all the major economies. So you're right. So the point is, on the scenario of labor shortage, and I appreciate your comments that you say it takes more time with trade unions, I would just like to add two aspects to it. One aspect, probably deflationary, would be automatization. You know, I think Japan is investing heavily into machinery, automatization, robotics, artificial intelligence. This could, you know, reduce the power of labor. On the other hand, we have the challenge of climate change policies. And I would probably argue that climate change policies are increasing demand and reducing globalization in a certain sense because you will have more localization, and this might increase then inflationary power. So what's your take on these two, you know, but maybe not complete, you could probably other trends as well, but what's your take on these?
Well, I'll take a first crack at it. Charles also has made some rather interesting points in the past. I'd love to hear from him as well. One of the key things to keep in mind is that I think the global demography dynamics that we're going to see in the future means that we really can't afford to have workers getting involved in tasks that are so repetitive that they can be done by a machine. We actually rather need robotics to get rid, especially in the advanced economies, of tasks that can be automated. Why is that? Because one of the points we try to make is that what we cannot anticipate today is the coming demand for lower skilled labor to look after the elderly. What we need is to understand that what the projections that we are getting from the UN population statistics do not show how an increasing part of the labor force will be involved in what we call socially productive activities, but not economically productive activities, because the services they provide will be consumed by the elderly, who will not then go on to produce anything else. So the shortage of labor in that area that we will need to fill needs to come from somewhere. And if immigration is very difficult in the current political climate, then we absolutely need automation to reduce some of the jobs in other parts and allow that reallocation of labor to flow towards looking after the elderly.
But coming back to the economic scenario, so we see a world with labor shortage, with less globalization, with more wage pressure, with higher inflation rates, as you pointed out, not tomorrow, but down the road. How does it work on the interest side? Because we all know that debt levels are historically high, especially if you combine public and private debt levels. We're adding to these high debt levels as we speak due to Corona. We have the call for many economists of saying governments should take on much more debt, given the fact that interest rates are so low. So in Germany, we make money on issuing debt. Let's assume inflation comes back. We would also see higher interest rates. But then we might see a major problem in the financial markets, don't we?
Indeed. And that is one of the reasons why we think that, at any rate, outside of the euro area, where the ECB is protected by treaty, there will be great pressure from the politicians on central banks to hold nominal interest rates very low and not to raise them as inflation starts coming back, which would mean that real interest rates at the short end would remain very low or perhaps even fall further, though the yield curve will, under these circumstances, steepen quite strongly, unless, of course, there's political pressure even further for yield curve control. And in either case, holding real interest rates down in this way, particularly with yield curve control, would add yet further to monetary growth and the likelihood that inflation would expand even faster. The only way, I'm afraid, in a square circle, is that we could have considerably higher taxation. And one of the consequences of the projections is that in order to stabilize inflation, stabilize debt and deficits, at the same time as looking after the old reasonably generously, there is probably no alternative but considerably higher taxation. But that is so politically unpopular that that is one reason why we think that the political optimal in future decades will again be somewhat faster inflation. The nicest way to deal with debt is to grow out of it. But the point is that the slowdown in the growth of the number of workers means that growth will slow towards the Japanese level unless we have a productivity miracle. And we do think that productivity will rise as there is more onshoring instead of offshoring, and that in order to maintain profitability at home, businessmen will be forced to try to raise productivity to hold down new labor costs. But we doubt again whether productivity will rise sufficiently to enable growth even to maintain the relatively sluggish levels of the last decade.
If you look at markets themselves, I think there is a grudging willingness to at least think about inflation right now. There are two or three simple points to make here. Number one, the major concern that both Charles and I have is that the signal from the market needs to be taken with caution around structural turning points. So most people look at 10-year, 20-year, 30-year yields and they say, look, we're just not seeing any sign of inflation anywhere. But if you look at the mirror image of that in the 1980s, the 10-year, 20-year, and 30-year yields were telling you that interest rates would remain at 8 and 9% for the next few decades. And that was completely wrong. So using that is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy to be surely wrong if we turn out to have some credibility in our thesis. Second is, if you look at the break-even curve, which is the difference between nominal interest rates and inflation-linked bonds, that break-even inflation curve is showing you rates that are higher everywhere than nominal interest rates. So some of the things that Charles was mentioning that people might be considering that in this level of debt, a point that you made earlier, central banks cannot really allow yields to rise to compensate everyone for inflation, which means financial repression of a kind. That might already be something that the market is looking at more seriously. But the biggest issue, where you're right, is that if you start allowing interest rates to rise because inflation is rising, the effect on financial stability, not just in equity prices, but also in the borrowing binge that we have undertaken in government finance and in housing, they are certainly at risk. And we have a very difficult task ahead of us, which I think central banks will really have to work hard to earn their salaries.
Yes, because if asset prices really drop, we have immediately a debt crisis. If now central banks do as you say, if they say, okay, we keep interest rates lower, we do yield control, we have higher inflation, then the inflation is going to feed into inflation even more because people are going to, the velocity of money would go up because we have we had a trend in the past 20 years, not only of higher debt levels and more debt, but also the issue around lower monetary velocity, money velocity. So would you see then the scenario of inflation starts and then the velocity of money goes up and the inflation is speeding up? Or would you say it's going to remain under control?
I think that there is a danger that it could speed up to a point at which it could become a serious problem again. But one of my concerns is that there are some in the central banking fraternity who say, don't worry, that even if inflation might come back, we know how to deal with it. And I think that that is horribly complacent. The reason I think that it's horribly complacent is that the effort and courage that Volcker had to show in 1979, 80, 81, and Reagan as well, was really quite remarkable. And the amount of debt, both public and private, at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, was probably not more than about a third in relationship to GDP of the level now. So if there were problems of financial stability, and remember that the Volcker shift in 79 led to the Mexican, Argentinian, and Brazilian crisis, which was the most severe financial crisis, really, of the post-war period, up until the great financial crisis itself. And in that period, virtually all the major city center banks in New York and elsewhere were actually on a mark-to-market basis. They were insolvent. So that it was a period of great financial danger, 1979, 1982. And the underlying situation now, because of the greater debt and the greater leverage around, is much, much worse. So that the idea that if inflation should rise, it's not going to be difficult to hit it on the head again. I think it is that when I hear that, I feel it is wildly and dangerously complacent.
I think the problem, Daniel, exactly as Charles is saying, is a lot of this doesn't look sustainable. If you allow inflation to rise with high debt, that doesn't sound sustainable given the stock of debt. If you let the US dollar strengthen aggressively so that everything else depreciates and you get a surge of inflation in the rest of the world, that sounds dangerous given where emerging market and growth has gone. And it's a problem on all sides, really. So I think the story that we're trying to get across here is not just a single movement up in one particular part of the economic complex that will kind of allow everything else to sustain itself at a separate equilibrium, but it's just this entire equilibrium shifting to a completely different mindset and a scenario that no one on the policy side or the market side certainly has adopted. It'll mean a seismic change if you're right. And even if you're partially right and you do get some of the resurgence we are talking about, it still requires a major rethinking of the path ahead of us in many different ways.
I see. And now I also remember what I wanted to ask before, because you made a side remark and saying all the central banks besides the Eurozone, but I cannot imagine the Eurozone being kind of the heaven of stability, given the high debt levels, given the demographic problems. And if they were, you know, the euro would become stronger and stronger, making it even more difficult for the European Central Bank to keep the system rolling. So what's your view then on the Eurozone in this context?
Well, I think that the point that you're making is already starting. It's already the case that the U.S. is much more expansionary, both fiscal and monetarily, than the Eurozone on both fronts. That means that the euro has been appreciating, and that's another problem with the Eurozone. So that the Eurozone is much more likely to have price stability, but is much less likely to have much growth over the next few years than the U.S. There is the really polar distinction between the two. So what you point out is already in motion.
But that's not sustainable.
Yeah, but the question then is, if that situation is not sustainable, what gives? How does what is not sustainable, how does that play out?
Well, what would you do? I don't know what would be the most powerful person in this regard. I think U.S. president doesn't fit. Probably the chief of the U.S. Fed, probably, or the chief of, you know, being the head of the IMF. So what would you do? You've got the scenario. The scenario is not a nice scenario. We had great 40 years. Now we're at a turning point and we have high debt levels. We cannot afford high interest rates. We have higher wages down the road. So what would you do in order to avoid major problems?
Well, the mainstream effectively says we're wrong. Inflation is low forever. Interest rates remain low.
But I don't assume you're wrong. I would assume you're right.
Well, it's not going to be easy. And I think one of the things that we have to do, and fairly quickly, as I said earlier, is to think what additional forms of taxation will help to stabilize the fiscal position of the public sector and have the minimal effect on growth, on economic distortions, and on social attitudes towards fairness. If we're going to avoid inflation, I think we're going to have much higher taxation. The question is, what kinds of taxation? How do we bring them in? Can you politically bring in higher taxation at a time when the mainstream is saying, don't worry about debt, don't worry about deficits, interest rates are going to remain low forever, the problems, underlying problems of demography are for another decade, let's close our eyes and plow on regardless. I think at the very least, those in power ought to be thinking about what tax rates need to be increased, how and when.
Not everyone would be unhappy with what we're saying, because if you look at some of the administrations that have either come into place or some of the social issues we've dealt with, one of the serious problems we've had is inequality. So part of the story that we are talking about is that inequality will fall within countries, which has been very difficult for anyone to solve. And the second is that the labor increase in labor bargaining power will allow them to accrue a little bit more of the growth and purchasing power for themselves in the future by getting some kind of after-tax increases in wages, which will compensate them for inflation. So it's not all bad news. I think the primary problem that seems to be the case is in the last 30 years, we had fantastic growth in financial market conditions at the expense of the social issue, which came into a head really after the great financial crisis. But if that's going to move some of the other way, it's partial compensation in a social sense for the loss of economic momentum, for this change in the growth mix. And partly policymakers, if you look at the statements coming out of the Federal Reserve from the European Central Bank, they are paying far more attention to ESG issues, to issues of social importance. And that may be something that does help mitigate some of the issues that will come up on the economic and financial side. It's possible.
What would be your outlook for the monetary order? If you now think about, let's take 40 years, you know, because you spoke about the 40 last years, let's think about the world in 40 years. What would be your view? Would we be still having the same monetary order? Would we go back to some kind of, you know, I'm not saying gold standard, but some kind of more stable currency of all this turmoil? Or what would be your vision? What's going to happen?
I shall be dead by then, quite certain that. So I'm not looking forward quite that. But to be honest, Daniel, you can't look forward 40 years. And the idea that you can have any kind of sensible, let alone rational, expectations about what the world will look like in 2060, I don't think that you can do this. I think that our point is that over the next 25 years, we're going to find a restoration of the kind of problems that we had in the 1970s, and in many ways worse, because for reasons that were straightforward at the time, we have run such low interest rate policies that we're entering the next 25 years with an enormous accumulation of debt. And that is going to make the next 25 years with the reversal of the beneficial effects of globalization and demography on our economies, it's going to be a great deal harder, and the problems of policy are going to become much more severe, particularly for central banks, than they have been in the last 30 years since we got central bank independence in 1990. I've said in public in several times that the last 30 years were the glory years of central banking, and they were very enjoyable for central banks. The next 30 years are going to be an extremely more difficult.
Manoj, you want to add something to this?
Well, I would only add that, you know, typically speaking, if you look at the path that people have ahead of them, and central banks make a very big deal out of this when big events are happening, they always say if there is an orderly appreciation or an orderly change in interest rates, we'll be fine. If it's a disorderly one, then we'll be more worried. I have yet to see a big event lead to an orderly change in things. So I think on your 40-year horizon, I have no foresight at all, but I think it will be a 4 to 5 year period in which the old equilibrium is shocked out of its complacency and into a new one. And once that new equilibrium happens, we will see much more action by policymakers and so on and so forth, which could mitigate some of the effects we're talking about. But I think the point we would try to bring forward is a lot of the things that we are saying might happen could be the trigger that jolts people into doing the things that they have to do. But it'll be a very difficult period, probably half a decade or so, going and changing our perspectives.
Well, dear Charles, dear Manoj, thank you very much for this outlook. Probably not as optimistic, and clearly, you know, the 40 years probably was a too long timeline. I appreciate the fact that the turmoil is coming earlier, most probably earlier. We will clearly see it as this decade. I think it would be my takeaway from the conversation with you. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thank you. Very glad to have had the opportunity. Very kind of you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.